SBS Audio is supported by advertising.
Need a few minutes to reset? Great Minds is a podcast from SBS that guides you through different meditation styles from around the world. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
SBS, a world of difference. You're with NITV Radio, on mobile, online and on radio.
We acknowledge the traditional owners of the land NITV Radio broadcasts from, the Wurundjeri Woiwurrung people of the Kulin Nation and their elders past and present. We also acknowledge all Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander tribes and clans we broadcast to, from the mountains to the plains, from the desert to the sea, from fresh water to salt water.
Yama, welcome to NITV Radio. Bertrand Tungandame there. I'm Bertrand Tungandame. Coming up in your program this Wednesday, the 31st of July, we have a conversation with Lisa Hope, a mixed cultural First Nations artist and curator born in Nam. She's one of the finalists of the 2024 Natsia Awards. WOP weaves together threads of lost history, ancestral relationships, motherhood, and the passage of time, culminating in contemporary expressions that speak to her past, present, and future. Also in the program today, we'll be joined by Wiradjuri Birunga, who'll be talking about the Indigenous Story Bridge Adventure Climb, a first-of-its-kind Indigenous tourism experience that provides a First Nations perspective on the history, art, culture and future of Mingin, Brisbane. NITV Radio today will also bring you crucial information about the pending shutdown of the 3G network. All these stories and more coming to you on NITV Radio after the latest news.
Australia Day 1972 saw the first Aboriginal embassy erected outside Parliament.
The native title legislation must be amended.
And they've walked this land so many times before anybody came.
I am sorry.
In this bulletin, First Nations community in Alice Springs launches a video supporting organ and tissue donation. Australian borrowers holding their breaths as July's inflation numbers are released. And in tennis, Alexei Popirin becomes the first Australian man in over a decade to make the third round in the Olympics. An educational video has been launched in Alice Springs as part of Donate Life Week, encouraging more First Nations people to get behind organ and tissue donation. The 5-minute educational resource on the organ transplant process has been designed and narrated by local First Nations health workers in English and in language. Last year, 3 people from the Northern Territory became organ donors after their death, up from 1 person in 2022. Bantwi traditional owner Benedict Stevens says he hopes the video provides more culturally appropriate information about organ donation.
Families do have a discussion whether to have kidney donation or just go to the renal dialysis whilst waiting for a donation. And sometimes some of our families out from the bush, we usually tell them that, you know, getting a donation, even though it's from a person that passed on, but it's going to save your life more, to stay a bit longer.
The Queensland Minister for Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander Partnerships has announced an agreement that will see several First Nations artefacts returned back to home soil. The agreement was made with the Museum of Vancouver, where the artefacts are currently being held, and was reached after days of negotiations. The items will be stored at the Queensland Museum when they arrive in Australia before they are returned to their respective communities.
This agreement is part of a state government's ongoing work to secure the return of sacred artifacts from museums and institutions around the world. Australia's inflation rate rose to 3.8% in the June quarter from a year earlier, up from 3.6% in March. The figures were released by the Australian Bureau of Statistics this morning, but the increase had been predicted by some economists. The inflation rate is still above the 2 to 3% range that the Reserve Bank wants to see. The Transport Workers Union says up to 850 workers will lose their jobs at Rex Airlines after the carrier entered voluntary administration and grounded all its Boeing 737 flights. Trips between major capital city airports have been cancelled, but regional services are still operating. Rival airline Virgin Australia is offering Rex customers with an existing ticket the opportunity to transfer free of charge to one of their flights. CEO Jane Hardiker told the ABC her company will also be trying to help Rex employees.
All Virgin Australia jobs that are open will get prioritised for Rex disaffected employees. And we're bringing on board three 737-800s out of the Rex fleet. If we're able to do that, that means we can bring on more Rex disaffected employees into new jobs. And that's really important to us to make sure that people in our industry are as well supported as they possibly can be.
Union head Michael Kane says the government should step in and take an equity stake in Rex in the short term. He told the ABC the airline industry needs change.
You know, Rex has nearly been monstered out of the market by Qantas only 4 weeks after Bonza was. And we've got to deal with those competitive pressures. And we need an independent decision maker to infuse the community interest, the interest of regional Australia, the interest of Australian workers, and not just be dictated to by the profit motivations of massive airlines and airports who are making billions in profits.
The federal government says it will enact large numbers of recommendations put forward by the Disability Royal Commission. Almost a year after the final report was handed down, Labor says it will accept 130 of the 172 recommendations the government has full or joint responsibility for. The commission had more than 10,000 stories over 4 years of public hearings, private sessions and written submissions. The government has pledged greater protection from discrimination and increased inclusion in society for those living with disabilities. Bill Shorten, Minister for the National Disability Insurance Scheme, spoke to the media a short while ago.
This is another watershed moment to stop the abuse of our fellow Australians. But there's a lot of work to go on from here. But this, I believe, will helpfully signpost the directions that we seek to take as a nation in the better treatment and the true equality of people with disability in Australia.
At least one person is reported dead and others wounded after the Israeli military carried out a strike on the Lebanese capital, Beirut, which it says targeted a prominent Hezbollah commander, Fuad Shukr. There were conflicting reports over whether Mr. Shukr had been killed. Lebanese security forces told Reuters he had survived, but SBS Arabic 24's Beirut correspondent says that may not be true.
It has not yet been announced by Hezbollah that Fuad Shukr has been killed, although sources have confirmed his death. The targeting operation was carried out while awaiting a statement from Hezbollah, which will serve as a basis for any future developments that may occur.
Israel blames Hezbollah for a deadly rocket attack in the Israeli-occupied Golan Heights on Saturday. The strike hit a village soccer pitch, killing 12 children. Hezbollah has denied any involvement in the attack. Authorities in southern India say more than 100 people have been killed in landslides and the death toll is continuing to rise. Intense rescue operations are underway but are being hindered by heavy rains and the collapse of a crucial bridge. Hills gave way after heavy rain sent rivers of mud, water and boulders on homes of workers and villagers. Around 150 people have been rescued, but many others remain missing and more heavy rainfall is expected. Excise Minister of Kerala, M.B. Rajesh, says soldiers and two Air Force helicopters have been mobilized to help rescue efforts.
We fear that the gravity of this tragedy is much more than these numbers. Rescue operations are being carried out on a war footing. Police, NDRF, Fire Force and various agencies are actively involved in rescue operations.
A police van has been set on fire and bottles thrown at officers during a protest at Southport in the UK in just hours after a vigil took place for the victims of a knife attack in which three children were killed. Police believe the protest involved supporters of the English Defence League and started near the location of the vigil. They say items were thrown towards a local mosque in what they called sickening scenes. Three young children died while five others and two adults are reported to be in a critical condition. A 17-year-old male is in custody on suspicion of murder. And back home, health authorities still don't know the source of an outbreak of Legionnaire's disease that has seen at least six people admitted to intensive care in Melbourne hospitals. The majority of the 33 patients infected so far have had to be treated for the severe form of pneumonia in hospital. Test results for a further 10 people suspected of having the disease are due soon, so the number of patients is expected to rise. Victoria's Chief Health Officer Claire Luca says she believes the source of the outbreak is a single air conditioning cooling tower somewhere in metropolitan Melbourne. And a new report has found that land clearing in Queensland and New South Wales kills around three koalas every day. The report examined data from 2016 to 2021 and says that on average 100 million native animals are displaced, injured or killed from land clearing in those two states every year. And now to sport. And in tennis, Australia's Alexei Popirin has beaten Swiss veteran Stan Wawrinka to set up a third round meeting with defending Olympic champion Alexander Zverev. The Sydney sider triumphed 6-4, 7-5 in what he says were some of the hottest conditions he's ever played in, as temperatures hit the high 30s at Roland Garros in Paris. Popirin is the only Australian left in the singles draw. He's also the third Australian man since Leighton Hewitt back in London in 2012 to reach the third round of an Olympic tennis tournament. And now having a look at the weather around the country this Wednesday afternoon, Perth, rain increasing and a possible storm, 21 degrees. Adelaide, partly cloudy, 17. Melbourne, partly cloudy as well, and 12. Hobart, similar conditions, 14. Albury, Wodonga, sunny, 13. Canberra, mostly sunny, 13. Wollongong, a shower or two, 15. Sydney, similar conditions with a top of 16. Newcastle, also a shower or two, 17. Brisbane, sunny, 21. Townsville, partly cloudy, 24. Cairns, possible shower, 25. Alice Springs, sunny, 20. Darwin, also sunny, 33. And the Torres Strait Islands, a mostly cloudy day and a top of 28 degrees. And that is NITV Radio News.
NITV Radio, Monday, Wednesday, Friday at 1 p.m. or anytime online.
You're listening to NITV Radio with you, me, Bertrand Ngandame, your host, this Wednesday, the 31st of July, 2024. Coming up next in the program, we have a conversation with Birunga Wiradjuri. We'll be talking about the Indigenous Story Bridge Adventure Climb, a first of its kind Indigenous tourism experience that provides a First Nations perspective on the history, art, culture and future of Mingin. Mingin is the Indigenous name for Brisbane. Also in the program today, we'll bring you crucial information about the pending shutdown of the 3G network across Australia. Will your tablet, mobile or other device be affected? Well, to find out, stay tuned on NITV Radio this Wednesday afternoon. But first, conversation with Lisa Wop. She's one of 72 finalists of the 2024 Natsia Awards. WOP weaves together threads of lost history, ancestral relationships, motherhood, and the passage of time, culminating in contemporary expressions that speak to her past, present, and future.
NITV Radio, share our stories on Facebook.
Joined by Lisa WOP, finalist in this year's Telstra National Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander Art Awards, the NATIAs, Australia's most prestigious art awards of their kind, presented on Larrakia Country by the Museum and Art Gallery of the Northern Territory and principal partner Telstra. Lisa WOP, first of all, thanks for joining us and welcome to NITV Radio.
Well, thank you so much for having me.
You're based in NAM and you're a multidisciplinary artist. Your art practice encompasses a diverse range of media. I can try to enumerate a few of them. Weaving, printmaking, photography, sculpture, and many more. Mm-hmm. Can you tell us about your art practice and also your entry in the awards?
Yes, of course. So as you mentioned before, yeah, I'm really materially driven. So I use a lot of different material, and I guess for me it's a way to be able to talk of story, you know, to be able to speak of things from what's happening now. I guess there's reflection of family in there as well, and connection to culture and country, and, you know, just how I kind of navigate that space. I see it as a platform to be able to tell these stories. So, you know, it was really important for me to be able to kind of be driven by a medium that would be able to help me express that. And I guess for the last few years, I've really been honing in on printmaking as a medium. So printing with papers or printing on diverse materiality as well, such as like bull kelp or, you know, just tapa cloth from Papua New Guinea and, you know, Marcy from Fiji. And so it's just, I guess, these experiences that I'm having in place, you know, and the material side of it is a huge part of that. So the work that I've created for the Telstras this year is titled Acknowledgement of Country. This is a screen print on four pieces of paper that have been stitched together.
Acknowledgement of Country, that's very powerful. That's not just about, it encompasses also protocol, not just country and family. And it's very, very powerful entry there.
And I'm really referring to the actual artwork, the drawn part of it that I've taken from to create this screen print is actually drawings of sandbags. So the idea of, you know, it's talking about, I guess, you know, creating these sandbags that would be used to protect, you know, somebody's property. And I guess this is kind of something that sparked off with me some years ago. My family had and I had gone to Niritchuka. I've got some family out that way. And at the time, they were having these impending floods. So we kind of spent time with them packing these sandbags. And this is when my kids were quite small. And then, you know, like, you know, last year, the year before, we hear about these floodings that's happening in, you know, New South Wales and in Victoria. So it's something that really kind of sparked this with me again. And the idea of actually using these physical sandbags as well is something that I've been doing in the past as well. So I guess it's kind of bringing in all of these together. But for me, the sandbags symbolise the ongoing impact of colonial intervention on our waterways. I guess the ever-present perils of climate change is something that is really the forefront of this work.
Yeah, no, that's a very, very powerful entry and acknowledgement of country and looking after country at the same time. A piece of work, you said, was a long time coming.
Yes.
And you just explained a little bit the process of making these. Can you tell us more? Because it sounds like something really very powerful and very deep.
It's been part of a process, this body of work, like it's kind of come off from another part of a series that's being kind of informed from another part of a series. So it's just like this evolving creation of this work, but in different kind of iterations of it. So this has really started back with using these actual sandbags that's actually in an exhibition that's going to open this week at the Australian Design Centre, and the exhibition is called Current. I'm alongside with Gail Marbo and Dominic White. It's been a touring exhibition since last year, and this will be the last iteration of it, but that exhibition has a body of work called Holding Country, and it has 365 sandbags that have been created into bags. So for me, bags represent mother, this holder and keeper. That was really one of the designs that was part of that series that's in acknowledgement of country, these drawings of these sandbags. So it's kind of changed material along its way. But it always comes back to paper, because paper is something that I really love working with. So yeah, but it's kind of growing a little bit in size.
Yeah, so, can you tell us which state this exhibition is taking place?
So it opens on Thursday, the 1st of August. So that's at the Australian Design Centre
in Sydney. Australian Design Centre in Sydney. I'll look that up.
It opens at 6 o'clock. At the Australian Design Centre, and I'm sure anybody's welcome. But it's in Darlinghurst is where the Australian Design Centre is. So those bags will be shown there alongside with amazing work from Gail Marbo and Dominic White. Yeah, so I'm really excited to see this last iteration of this exhibition.
How does it feel being one of the finalists in one of the most prestigious art awards? And especially,
oh my goodness,
only two of you from Melbourne this year. Usually NAM has more participants or entrants or finalists.
Yes.
But this year, ironically, one of the biggest states has the least, finalists of all states.
Yeah, definitely. I don't think there's normally a huge amount from Victoria. But yeah. It's always good to see us on that map. You know, I think it's something that's, I think it's really important for us to be able to express our stories from down south, you know, like it's, part of that connection of the whole country. So it's I always get great sense of pride when we see Vic mobbed up there, or, you know, people that live in Victoria that are participating in the Natsias. I think it's really important. And even like, you know, for years I worked at Bullock Arts, which was an Aboriginal arts centre in Mornington. So, you know, for a long time, there was no Vic on the map for DAF either. So
yeah,
and now there is. There's, so it's really wonderful to see the inclusion of, you know, our stories as well.
You know, the finalists' artworks will be displayed, you know, at the Art Museum and Art Gallery of the Northern Territory from the 8th of August, I think, till early 2025. What impact do you hope your work will have on those who see it at the museum and Art Gallery exhibition?
Oh, look, I'm just so honoured to be a part of it. You know, it's something that I really try to get up there every year. You know, it's a really big part of, I don't know, for me, it's, you know, it's like this incredible place that you go to and you can connect with mob from all over the country. And, you know, it's kind of happens more times than once a year, but in Darwin it happens once a year, and it's something that I really try to get to each year. So to be a part of that and to be in the company of such incredible artists that I've admired for years, you know, to be showing my work alongside of them is, you know, a huge honour. So I'm super excited to be a part of it. Yeah, really, really. I was just, really, really excited to know that I was a finalist.
Yeah, no, it's excellent. It's one of the most prestigious, and just being part of it, even besides being a finalist, just being a participant is a really, really a very prestigious thing to be part of.
Yes,
now,
definitely.
Before I let you go, any closing words, or maybe can you share a little bit more about what is upcoming in terms of your art? What project have you got in the pipeline coming up?
There's a few things in the pipeline. I think the most immediate one is an exhibition at Gertrude Glasshouse. So I've been a Gertrude contemporary artist in NAM for the last 2 years. So I just finished my 2-year space as a studio artist there in August. So this will be the final exhibition that I have with Gertrude. And Gertrude, you know, to be a part of that collective has been an incredible, you know, honour as well and an experience to be there. So I'm really looking forward to bringing out this next body of work that I've been working on since I've been a part of the artist there. So I think that's the next thing that's coming up, which I'm really excited about. Yeah, just working on, you know, I lecture at Melbourne Uni as well. So I'm kind of starting back with students last week, and this week I, you know, keep going. So that's something that I really love doing as well, being a part with the students. I can't get past Darwin at the moment, to be honest.
Yeah, I can understand.
So that exhibition that I mentioned is called Muddy Edges, and that will open on the 31st of August in Naarm at Gertrude Glasshouse. And then we've got Radiant Pavilion coming up in September. So I'm actually fortunate enough to be in an exhibition that has travelled. This will be the third iteration of it now, called Deep Material Energy 3. And it's also with artists from New Zealand and some artists from Melbourne as well, from Naarm. So, and I'll be curating an exhibition at RadPav at the same time too, called Shared Ground at Gallery Funaki. So that's really exciting also, which opens on the 21st of September.
Wow.
So it's all, anybody's welcome.
Yeah, you're really busy for the rest of the year.
I think so. I need a holiday now. Yeah.
No, I don't know where you get the energy to do all that, you know, your art practice, your university work, teaching and all that. Wow, very, very busy.
Yeah.
Lisa Wop, congratulations on being a finalist on one of the most prestigious art awards. And thanks a lot for joining us on ITV Radio today.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me.
We must now go to a break, but stay with us, because when we come back, we have a story about a first-of-its-kind Indigenous climb of the Story Bridge in Brisbane. This will provide a First Nations perspective on the history, art, culture and future of Mengen Brisbane.
Visit sbs.com.au/NITV Radio.
Now, a new Indigenous tourism experience, the Indigenous Story Bridge Adventure Climb, designed to immerse tourists in history and culture of First Nations knowledge and stories, has recently opened in Brisbane. To learn more, we caught up with Birunga Wiradjuri of the Birunga Art Gallery, one of the key players in the making of this project.
The climb goes for about 2 hours. You know, you are up there for a fair while. It's certainly, you don't just get up and come back down, but it's a short period of time, and the information that's available, I mean, you're standing there looking at, you know, there's a particular school there that gets, you know, celebrated, and but the story that we've got there is, you know, they talk about it being an amazing thing for putting young women through and all that sort of jazz, but what they don't talk about is, you know, they had First Nations girls from here in servitude there, unpaid. One of those then girls was only dawn daylight up here, you know, so we can tell those sorts of stories. And I guess it, my commitment then is to have the young ones, like say young Kane Brungie, Taisha Martin King. So Kane's Gunguri Kabi Kabi lad, Taisha's Bunjalung from down by Yugal, and then there's Jess Skeen, who's a Gukul Taipan girl, and they're artists in their own right. We'll work together to develop the framework that will sort of inform how that grows and develops. And then I guess, you know, let's see what happens from there. But investing, you know, significant time in developing it so that it's a stable and organic, if that makes sense, you know what I mean? Like, it's got to have everyone's flavor, you know, each individual or each mob's flavor too, really, into it about how they tell their stories. But basically, we make sure that we're solid in what we do say and what we don't say, how we say it, and about letting people really know, again, that thing about having that cultural authority here. We need to make sure that we're responsible with that.
And it's said that the climbs are not just about storytelling. There is also sampling Indigenous foods and including you know, native herbs and spices, and there is also the throwing of boomerangs and painting workshops. It's a lot of things to experience during a short period of time. What can you tell us about these other experiences?
I mean, we've been up there a few times now, four, five, six times. And I remember going up with Jess and T. And so what happens, you're on the south side of the river up to Kangaroo Point, and you go up the eastern side of the bridge, you go up to the peak, you have a bit of a Doris, tell the stories and, you know, whatever. Then you go down that side to about halfway, and you walk across over the roadway, and then you reverse it, right, and you come back. And when we were coming back on the city side, Jess and I had a moment that, I don't know, something else was going on. We just sort of, and she said to me and T, she's looked over, she's gone, that park down there. And we're looking down. And she said, oh, I can still remember. So when she was a little girl, her dad, Uncle Joe Skeen, used to teach Japanese tourists how to throw the boomerangs down there, right? They'd be a bit iffy about it, about doing it, because they didn't want to lose face, or, you know, like, they didn't want to get it wrong. So Uncle Joe would get Jess, who's the youngest daughter or the youngest of the kids, to come through, and it was almost like, oh, well, if she can do it, you can do it thing. So she'd come in and throw the boomerang. And so we're standing up, you know, top, and she's telling me stories about about all this sort of stuff going on.
Yeah.
And then we have our own catering. We offer, I think they call it a native tasting platter. So you got roux, croc, emu, and then if it's like, you know, finger lime and all that sort of jazz through it. They're pretty, I had one. I was sort of had a bit of a graze on one yesterday. They continue to be very good. But then Jess is going to do a boomerang painting workshop down the bottom, which will be an addition, you know, after the climb. I took my time to come around to it because I'm not really a fan of that kind of, well, you're nearly a ticker box kind of thing, you know, like, oh, let's paint a boomerang and get to know the blackfellas or whatever. And not to be dismissive, I mean, these things, if they're purposeful and there's a point to it, I'm all for it. If it's just ticking a box, I'm not. And I talked to Jess about it, and what ends up being the thread through that interaction is they get a different perspective because they've just been up the bridge, say, with me, and they've got some different stories. They come back down, and then they're going to be hearing about, I don't even call it, they call it fake art, but it's not even art. Like, you know, that cultural appropriation type stuff.
Yeah.
So she uses that workshop then to, because Uncle Joe has developed this amazing entrepreneurial business over decades where the Skeens produce, among other things, you know, boomerangs and other artifacts for sale for tourism. It's made by mob sort of thing. So there's just going to be some interesting opportunities open up for us to do things on our own terms. And I think, you know, the main thing is that we tell stories. You know, when you hear that thing, stories in inverted commas, I don't know what people think. You tend to find people are getting all, you know, ready to sit down and hear about the dream time in inverted commas or something like that.
Yeah.
But the reality is what we're doing is it's through our lens. You know, this is our experience. This is through our lens. These are the timings, the considerations, the protocols, the ceremonies, the whatever's our experiences through our lens for them to consider.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, then that gives them pause. If that's all we achieve, if it just gives them pause to reconsider, and then that is you know, that stays in their psyche, then it's a good day.
You said the tours offer a safe and culturally sensitive experience to visitors, but one wouldn't really wrap this up without talking about the importance of environmental stewardship and
and
traditional ecological knowledge.
So I'll give you an example. When we were up there the other day, I had a local TO. She's like my little sister, Madonna Thompson. She's Uncle Neville Bonner's granddaughter/grandniece, cultural knowledge holder, wonderful human being. I had a yarn to her. Somehow the topic of the river came up. And I said to her, you know, just quietly and respectfully, I said, Sissy, your river, I always get this feeling of, whenever I look at it, you know, it's beautiful and all that, she's beautiful and all that, but I always get this feeling about sadness, and I always get this feeling about grief and that it's not very well, you know. And we sort of stopped what we're doing, and that was the start of this yarn. And what I didn't know was, well, she said, well, there's actually a reason for that. The yarn is that down river from where we are, which is Kangaroo Point, downriver down near Hamilton there, there was two places you could walk across the river. One was up at Toowong, and one was down towards Hamilton. The one down Hamilton was because there was a sandstone reef down there. And that sandstone reef meant that it was close enough to the surface so that the fresh water coming down ran over the top of the salt water, and the salt water never, it couldn't get high enough so that it could get over the reef so that the river was tidal. So prior to this particular event that happened, and there's colonial records where, you know, all the way up, so the river itself was a lot narrower, the banks were a lot less steep, you know, and erosion will do that, but they also, you know, they also carved or blew the stone out of the cliffs around Kangaroo Point, sort of south bank. But they've got records that say there was all these billabongs all the way up. The records that Madonna told me about was that these fellows, these colonials, they were in a boat up around Ipswich, where Ipswich is now. And their records said that the bottom of the river's aggregates, like gravel, and in fact, like up at Kurilpa there, up at Kurilpa Point, there's a concrete plant, and they were just using all the gravel out of the river there, you know. I don't think they still use it. Anyway, the yarn was that at that time, you could stand in your boat and look at the deepest part of the river and see clearly to the bottom, you could see the smallest pebble in clear detail. But what ended up happening was they wanted to get ships up into, I guess it's a city now, but it must have been a town then. It was in the, I can't remember, maybe early 1900s. They gel-ignited that sandstone reef. Upriver used to have beaches where mob used to gather and all that sort of jazz, you know, and the river was a whole lot different. But as soon as they blew that reef out, the river became tidal. Now you've got whalers, you know, all the way up and down and all that sort of jazz. So, you know, attempts to tell any of the stories of country here, other than the ones that are contemporary or the ones that we've been told by the TOs that we can, you know, culturally, that's just the way we are. We're just respectful and know our place in that regard. But that would be the example that I would use about one of the stories that we use anyway. And then, you know, I told it to those people there the other day, and they actually could feel the sadness. They looked at the water. I said to them, what colour do you reckon that water is? And that time of day, it was getting towards dusk. They said green. And I said, well, okay, so here's the yarn. You know, if this hadn't happened, but this bridge was here, you'd be standing and you'd probably be able to see the bottom. You might even be able to see the fish swimming around, you know, that sort of stuff.
And that was Berenga Wiradjuri, one of the key players in a new Indigenous tourism experience, the Indigenous Story Bridge Climb in Brisbane. We must now go to a break, but stay with us. When we come back, we bring you all you need to know before the 3G network shuts down.
Join the conversation on radio, online and mobile. You're with NITV Radio.
Welcome back. You're listening to NITV Radio, and I'm Bertrand Tungandami, your host today, broadcasting from Nam on the Kulin Nation. Now, with just over a month to go until the 3G network shuts down, Australians are being urged to check whether their mobile phones will be impacted. A key concern is that people will be unable to make emergency calls once the network retires. So how do you know whether you need an upgrade to upgrade your device, or what do you need to do? Well, Abby O'Brien explains.
First launched in Australia 20 years ago, the 3G network revolutionised the way we communicate. Considered to be the first high-speed mobile network generation, it helped pave the way for the smartphone, making it possible to browse the internet, watch television and make video calls. Dr. Faraz Hassad is a telecommunications expert at the University of New England.
3G essentially introduced fast internet browsing on people's phones and set the stage for the development of innovative applications that we use today. So 3G can be viewed as the foundation on which further progress of mobile phone technology was based.
Now the 3G network is set to shut down across Australia to boost the capacity of the 4G and 5G networks. Australia's mobile network operators have been preparing to retire their networks since 2019. Dr. Faisal Bouhafs is from the University of New South Wales School of Systems and Computing.
It was bound to happen. Many countries around the world are already doing that. If you switch on to 4G and 5G, you will have better performance and better quality of service in terms of connectivity.
While TPG, which owns Vodafone, made the move in January, Telstra plans to retire its 3G network at the end of August and Optus in September. It's not just mobile phones that are affected. Tablets, smartwatches, FPOS machines, fire alarms and medical equipment that rely on 3G will also be impacted. And so Australians are being urged to check their devices. Faraz Hassan says a major concern is that people will be unable to make emergency calls.
There are some 4G devices that are configured by their manufacturers to switch back to 3G when they're making 000 calls. So what we need to do is check whether our mobile phones are, the mobile phones we are using are compatible with 4G technology or not. If my phone is not compatible with 4G or 5G, I'll need to replace that.
Affected mobiles are typically those manufactured prior to 2019. But Louise Hyland, Chief Executive of the Australian Mobile Telecommunication Association, says other devices may also be impacted.
There are certain phones bought overseas that may not be supported on the Australian networks. There's also a grey market that exists for phones, and they may not be compliant with Australian standards.
So how do you know if you'll need an upgrade? Telstra and Optus customers can text 3 to the number 3498 and you'll receive a reply informing you whether or not your device will need to be replaced. Ms Hyland says the Australian Mobile Telecommunications Association has also developed a web-based tool.
We've set up a website at 3gclosure.com.au and go to that website to find out all the information you need to know to make an informed decision. The website's set up in 11 languages, including Arabic, Greek, Hindi, and Mandarin.
If you do need a replacement and are concerned about the cost, you're advised to contact your provider. And people who have old 3G phones they can no longer use are being urged to recycle them. Abby O'Brien, SBS News.
Your community, your conversation. NITV Radio.
That was Kulbaya Daye, a beautiful song by Christina Nu. And with this song, well, that's all we have that's all from us on NITV Radio this Wednesday afternoon. Your program will be back on Friday with more stories from right across the country. Thank you very much for your company this Wednesday afternoon. I am Bertrand Tungandami. Till next time, bye for now. Yalu.
Need a few minutes to reset? Great Minds is a podcast from SBS that guides you through different meditation styles from around the world. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.